please tell your mom, anytime she comes to St. Paul, Minnesota, mm-hmm. I would be honored if she would come to my house. And I will make her a traditional American dinner.
Raw goat testicles, done right, with the scrotum still attached.
Hey, what's happening, everybody? Welcome back to My Life as a Foodie. My name's Phil, and today we're talking about life on the farm. The truth about what happens to cute little farm animals in order for us to eat them. And some audio that some of you may find a little disturbing, but, you know, hey, that's life on the farm. But listen, I wanted to give a shout-out as well to a few new listeners. Nick in Wisconsin has commented on a few items already. I went and I checked out his blog. Holy shit, you want to talk about some talent. Nick is apparently a graphic artist and has some really cool paintings in his portfolio. And I'm always impressed with artists because I love art, you know, and I try to do as much as I can to promote it and be as artful as I can in the things that I do. And it's always great to meet new artists, especially those who can draw and paint. Because I've always felt that that takes special talent, more so when it's done really, really well, which is the case with Nick, because he's got this, he's got his own look, and they're really good. I mean, it is fine art. So, and I, you know, don't know his website offhand, but I'm sure he'll comment again, and he'll put a link there. And if not, you can go back into a couple of the other blog posts. I think he commented on the Brie post that I did, the Normandy Brie. So check his stuff out. Also, I got a great piece of feedback from Mary, who's the district manager for Southern California Sur La Table stores. She commented on the molecular cooking episode. She really likes the blog, appreciates the publicity that I gave the store for the molecular gastronomy class. I thought it was nice of her to take the time to comment. So I wanted to say thank you to Mary, if you're listening. There's some really interesting things we're going to do on the show today. I hope it doesn't go too long, but if it does, oh well. We don't do as many shows as we were doing before, so sometimes they're longer. Today, I'm going to do something I have not done before on the show. I'm going to read a story to you because it's a cool story, and I don't want to just talk about the story. I want to read it. It's a bedtime foodie story from Uncle Philly. All right, consider it a gift that you never got from me when you were a kid. All right, this is an article from the February issue of Bon Appetit magazine by Hugh Garvey. And it's titled The Road to River Cottage. It's a nice story about a foodie family that travels to the English countryside to meet conscious eating guru Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall, who we're also going to talk about a little later in the show. He has a farm in Devon in England. And I know I'm going to mispronounce a lot of words in this story. I'm going to get names wrong, but so be it. That's just how I am. There, while they're there at River Cottage, they discover the true meaning of farm-to-table eating. So, tuck in, get your pillow nice and tight against your head. Uncle Phil is going to read you a story. And, you know, I think maybe we should have a little music for this. Can we get some music? Maybe? Yeah, some music? Dude, no, come on, Jesus, no. It's a bedtime story, something nice. Yeah. That's, yeah, see, now you're talking. That's beautiful. Okay, just keep playing that. Play some more of that. The Road to River Cottage by Hugh Garvey. The photograph on the cover of the River Cottage cookbook shows a man in a barn coat carrying an adorable piglet under each arm as he strolls across a verdant pasture. The man is Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall, a cookbook author and TV celebrity who in recent years has become England's leading proponent of ethical eating. He preaches a religion of sustainability, small-holding agricultural production, and resistance to the evils of factory farming. He packages it in a seductive agrarian fantasy, hence the barn coat and rolling pasture and photogenic livestock, the latter of which ends up in delicious recipes like roast chicken with honey and couscous, and clams with pork tenderloin and chorizo. And none of it was working on my 4-year-old son, Desmond. Seeing the photograph for the first time, Desmond said, "That man's gonna kill those little piggies. They're too cute to eat." I decided then and there that I'd take Desmond, my 7-year-old daughter Violet, and my wife Amy to England to meet our dinner face-to-face and learn once and for all the facts of life as a modern omnivore. In southern England, on the Dorset-Devon border, Fernley Whittingstall runs a cooking school and multimedia operation out of a farm called River Cottage. Here, he teaches the foodies of England how to think, shop, cook, and eat ethically and sustainably. It sounded like Valhalla to me, being the kind of father who thinks that culinary honesty is the best policy, that we need to tell our kids where their food actually comes from. I know it sounds pretty basic, but in much of America, we've been raised not to own up to the realities of Old MacDonald had a farm, with the unsung subtext, and on that farm he killed a pig. At a recent party on my block in open-minded Los Angeles, a neighbor served a whole suckling pig, head still on. Half of the guests declined to eat a bite, shocked by the stark reminder of where their ham sandwiches actually come from. America wasn't always so removed from its agrarian roots, as I was reminded while reading the Laura Ingalls Wilder classic Little House on the Big Woods to Violet. There's nearly an entire chapter devoted to the finer points of pig slaughter and butchery, including an idyllic scene of a young girl savoring roast pigtail. The same week that I read this chapter to my daughter, I came upon mention of an edible pigtail in Fernley Whittingstall's River Cottage Meat Book, another British bestseller. So off we went on a family pilgrimage to River Cottage to meet those little piggies on the cover of the cookbook, or at least their second cousins, and the man who would take them to slaughter with a smile. After landing in London, we spent a restorative night at the luxurious Berkeley Hotel in Knightsbridge. A visit to River Cottage is a nice day trip from London, but we have a big day ahead of us. The next morning we take a 2.5-hour train ride down to the Dorset-Devon border, to the little market town of Axminster, a few miles from River Cottage. I'd signed us all up for a private cooking class, one of some 115 courses a year in everything from pig in a day for owners of small farms, to walk on the wild side, mushroom foraging, and green kitchen garden. In 1989, Fernley Whittingstall got his start in the culinary world, working in the kitchen of London's influential River Cafe. His media career began when he wrote a series of newspaper articles on cooking and eventually the cookbook Cuisine Bon Marche. Soon thereafter, he found success as a host of a TV program called A Cook on the Wild Side, which covered foraging for native foods and even the preparation of roadkill. River Cottage started as a vacation rental for Fernley Whittingstall and his family, but soon proved to be fodder for the rest of his career. Planting and cooking from his cottage's garden connected Fernley Whittingstall to the idea of homegrown modern British cooking in a way that inspired more cookbooks, cooking shows, and the eventual purchase of his current 65-acre spread. This is where the man called HFW by his foodie fans runs his empire and films many of his television shows, and where we were going to get the River Cottage treatment firsthand in a day of picking vegetables from the garden, learning how to cook sustainable English food, drinking English wine, and meeting Fernley Whittingstall himself. Presumably, we'd also be hanging out with some little piglets. When we arrive, a red tractor is waiting for us at the top of the hill, ready to take us down the road to the farm. The sun is out after a week of rain, and the hills of Axminster could not be any greener. We're met by Fernley Whittingstall's resident host, Stephen Lamb, who looks like an English Owen Wilson, and Simon Hansford, River Cottage's head gardener. A turn in the road reveals a huge white canvas yurt, a not unstylish composting outhouse, and several rustic chic farm buildings. We're met by more telegenetic chefs and staffers. It looks a bit like a reality TV set, which in fact it is. In the converted 18th century cow barn that serves as River Cottage's main classroom, we're presented with snacks prepared by the kitchen staff. In addition to hot chocolate and brownies, we're also given little savory bites, including some charcuterie on toothpicks. My kids wolf them down, and then have seconds. I ask the chef what they are, and I learn that my kids are basically eating head cheese lollipops. We tour the sprawling grounds with Stephen and Simon, and are schooled in River Cottage's sustainable plan. Cisterns gather rainwater, no outside compost or fertilizer is brought in, and the vegetable garden is fertilized with waste from the pigsty. Amy, an avid gardener, marvels at the greenhouse growing the fresh herbs and salad greens that we pick for our lunch. We learn that while River Cottage grows all it can, the volume of food cooked in its extensive catalog of courses requires them to source from nearby farms that practice sustainable agriculture. In fact, some of the courses are taught by local farmers themselves. So River Cottage is not only a school, it's a sort of incubator for the surrounding farmers, giving them work, buying their harvest, and exposing them to a larger market. Visitors to River Cottage hail from throughout the UK and beyond. The grown-ups' discussion of agriculture and microeconomics is interrupted when Violet howls after grabbing a stinging nettle. Stephen finds a floppy green plant on the ground and plucks a leaf. He rubs it on Violet's injured palm and explains that this soothing weed called broadleaf dock is often found growing near nettles. We say hi to a big sow and her litter of piglets. After our tour, the kids make sausage from the relatives of the piglets we just saw, and presumably of the River Cottage cookbook cover models. Desmond doesn't blink as he feeds pieces of fresh pork into the big industrial sausage grinder, with a huge photograph of cute bunny rabbit carcasses on the wall behind him. The photograph is the kind of thing that would disturb many. But to the disciples of River Cottage, it's a soothing and bucolic image. Unlike the caged chickens HFW has fought hard to liberate, the conscious foodies all know that these bunnies lived about the best life imaginable, hopping about the fields of Devon before meeting their fate. That moment between a life happily lived and mealtime is not only missing from our consciousness, it's missing from reality, thanks to intensive factory farming. The photo is very British agrarian fantasy, all creatures great and edible. We make pizzas in the wood-burning oven and then have a lunch sourced entirely from the farm. Again, the pig, a roast pork loin with cracklings, root vegetables, and sautéed purple sprouting broccoli. We wash it down with English wine, an undetermined varietal but still delicious. For dessert, it's rhubarb sorbet. This is true localvore eating, though admittedly we stomped a hefty carbon footprint with the 5,000-mile plane ride across the pond. And then Hugh Fernley Whittingstall himself comes in wearing muddy wellies. He's fit and trim, much more so than the standard-issue American TV food celebrity. Maybe it's because he's farming half the time. He's earnest and warm and welcoming. I ask him whether his conscious cooking revolution in Britain is as serious and widespread as it seems to me an outsider. Just 10 years ago, it was all about what a chef could do in the kitchen, and now he says, "I'm Gordon Ramsay's livestock guru." Now we're getting to the point where providence must be part of your arsenal. When Ramsay wants to train his chefs in butchery, he sends them here. Gordon Ramsay cooks for rich people, I point out, and classes at River Cottage range from $260 for a 9-hour class to $1,600 for a private lesson. What about the rest of the population? Fernley Whittingstall points to the victories of the past few months. Thanks to the Chicken Out campaign, many of Britain's largest supermarket stores sold out of free-range chickens, he says. Cage-free egg sales in Britain are increasing, and this proves it's not just an elitist project. The big challenge, he admits, is how do you get people to change their habits when they believe that eating fast food and processed junk food is just cheaper and easier? Well, we've learned you basically have to physically go to them. To change couch potatoes, you have to aim your best weapon at where they sit. So Fernley Whittingstall uses TV series such as the River Cottage Treatment to do just that. In the River Cottage Treatment, HFW challenges a group of diehard urban junk food devotees to give up their wicked ways in favor of home-cooked sustainable food like rabbit stew and spicy organic lamb burgers. And his creative activism isn't just limited to television. Last year, he bought a single share in British supermarket giant Tesco so that he could attend a shareholders meeting to lobby for improvements in the company's animal welfare standards. Desmond and Violet have gotten up from eating their locally grown rhubarb sorbets and are now running around the yard. Desmond stirs water in the train cistern with a stick. Violet talks to the laying hens in their pen. HFW and his wife moved to the country when their son Oscar was just 2 years old. That was the same year Oscar helped deliver his first lamb, HFW says. And just last week, 7 years later, Oscar and I watched a mother lamb eating the afterbirth while a bull calf was having its first suck. Oscar asked, "Is it a boy or a girl?" I told him it was a boy. He said, "That's a shame." I asked why. Oscar said, "Because he'll be meat." He paused and then he said, "But he'll make good meat." Oscar is saddened by it, but he still eats meat. He understands what it's all about. Yes, it's easy to be charmed by a lamb's antics in spring, but in the end, it's about them becoming meat. That's the deal. And that is the deal with my children. And the rest of our children, they have to know. Meeting the piggies did not keep my little ones from eating them at lunch. A pig is no longer an abstract cute thing. It's a muddy, friendly animal that lives on a farm for a purpose. For us to eat. For us to live. I've never said it to them in so many words. And now I don't have to. Having visited the model of a perfect farm and eaten the delicious food it yields, they couldn't be any more satisfied. Back in London, we have lunch at St. John, the restaurant that spawned the nose-to-tail culinary movement celebrating humble cuts. I look at my table and I feel there's hope for an honest foodie family future. Violet and Desmond don't hesitate to eat the marrow straight out of a bone. They literally have a knife fight over a platter of Neil's yard cheese, leaving only the rinds for Amy and me. After lunch, my kids climb onto a scooter emblazoned with the restaurant's logo, a pig with his primal cuts outlined as at an abattoir, ready for slaughter. His limbs outstretched, he looks as if he's in flight, a porcine angel destined for heaven. The end. Now get your Uncle Phil your beer. Maron. Oof, phenomenal. That was a tough one. I've done some voiceovers in my time, but Maron, that was not a story that was written to be read out loud. That's an editing nightmare. Hey, speaking of beer, Jeffrey T. actually commented that he noticed the Beer Safari links were gone off the site. I took them down. I took almost all the beer stuff down. I don't know if it'll be permanent. I don't know how long I'll keep it off. I just wanted to focus on food for a while because I just kind of got a little too carried away with the beer thing. And so if any of you are wondering if I'm, you know, if I've given up on the whole beer thing, I haven't. But for now, I'm just focusing on food, and I want to continue focusing on that. So there is a distinction that this is a food show, and I wanted to make sure that everyone understood. But while we're on the subject, I am still an advocate of Beer Safari. My buddy's at beersafari.com. It's a jungle of beer. If you're into beer, listening to shows about beer and podcasts that are just 100% all about beer, beersafari.com. And all my friends are there, and they're quality podcasts. And Jeffrey T. at The Good Beer Show is the godfather of podcasting, as far as I'm concerned. There is no better. But today, I'm going to be doing something here. I got this great article from my friend Tim, better known as Paradox, from Brain Gravy, who's also on Beer Safari. They do a podcast about once every 2 years. He sent me a link to an article that seriously pissed me off. To no end, really, pissed me off. And it's going to piss you off, too. Should this thing go anywhere, we are all going to need to act very quickly. We're going to spread the word as fast as we can, and we're going to stop the bullshit. This site is called cryptogon.com. I'm going to have to put a link on it because the link is kind of messed up. It's all numbers and shit. But let me ask you something. What would you say if I told you that you would soon need to say goodbye to your farmer's market and all farmer's markets? Well, I'm going to introduce you to H.R. 875, better known as the Food Safety Modernization Act of 2009. And it reeks of way too much government, which is something we really need to squelch as quickly as possible. Basically, what this is designed to do is force anybody who produces food of any kind, as in farmers, and then transports it to a different location for sale, like the farmer's market, to register with a new federal agency that they're calling the Food Safety Administration. Wonderful. Because the Food and Drug Administration wasn't enough, and they're so busy not doing their jobs that we need a whole new organization to muck things up. Even the smallest growers who just sell fruit and vegetables at farmers markets would not only have to register and pay for that, and pay for the right to register, they would be subject to invasive inspections by federal agents on their property, and all of the records that relate to food production, which means they'd have to keep records, and exactly how often the inspections happen would be determined basically whenever the Food and Safety Administration feels like doing their job. They're mandatory safety records that are going to have to be kept by all these farmers, and anybody who fails to register and comply with all this nonsense could be facing a fine of up to $1 million per violation. Now, if you know farmers, as this article does point out, you're going to know exactly they don't really have a lot of a big soft spot for the government in the first place. They really don't like the government, and I don't blame them. And they're pretty much going to rely on this new agency to show up and start asking for registrations before they're actually going to think about acting on it. So even if it does happen, it'll be a long way off, but the thing is, it actually could happen. And more than likely, we're going to see a fraction of these people operating if it does, if at all. I mean, I think it could outright kill it. So I'm going to read some of this to you, although it's boring. 111th Congress, First Session, H.R. 875, to establish the Food Safety Administration within the Department of Health and Human Services to protect the public health by preventing foodborne illness, ensuring the safety of food, improving research on contaminants leading to foodborne illness, and improving security of food from intentional contamination and for other purposes. What they're designing this basically to sound like is that they're concerned for our safety because of all the food scares and epidemics and E. coli outbreaks that we've had in the past few years. And almost all those have come from farmers at the farmer's market, right? Not from Ecuador or Mexico or some other third world shithole sending their produce here uninspected. No, local community farmers, they're the culprit. Those are the bad guys. You need to be protected from them. But here's how it's going to affect any grower that sells at a farmer's market. By definition, Category 5 food establishment. The term Category 5 food establishment means a food establishment that stores, holds, or transports food products prior to delivery for retail sale. The term food establishment means a slaughterhouse, except those that are regulated under the Federal Meat Inspection Act or the Poultry Products Inspection Act, factory, warehouse, or facility owned and operated by a person located in any state that processes food, or a facility that holds, stores, or transport food for food ingredients. So, you ask, what about fruits and vegetables? Are they affected? Yes, they are. The term food means any product intended to be used for food or drink for a human or an animal and components thereof. So they have to register with this new branch of government. Any food establishment or foreign food establishment engaged in manufacturing, processing, packing, or holding food for consumption in the United States shall register annually with the administrator, meaning pay up, buttercup. We need more money. And those who aren't greasing the wheel enough are going to get pushed out, probably. It sounds like the mafia. This is like the godfather of food. Unbelievable. Registration under this section shall begin within 90 days of the enactment of this act. Each such registration shall be submitted by the Secretary through an electronic portal and shall contain such information as the Secretary, by guidance, determines to be appropriate. And according to this proposed act, even if you don't sell directly to consumers, they're still going to show you up to your farm whenever they want, put a flashlight up your ass, and check you out and tell you what to do. Now listen, I don't say this all that often. I try not to curse on the show, but what the f***? Dude, what was that? What'd you bleep me for? You don't have to bleep me, dude. I'm on a podcast. It's a podcast. I can say that word. Seriously, you're killing me over here. Anyway, at what point are we going to stop being governed? I mean, this is their idea of helping us out? I mean, you want to talk about food safety. You're looking at the wrong group of people. And take a look up the FDA's ass. They're not inspecting 10% of the food coming into our country from other sources. And that's the food that's getting people sick. It's rotten disease laced with poop. Thank you, Pantscast. Now, you're going to go after the one safe source we do have, the people who won't sell to the grocery stores and co-ops, who refuse to have the hell taxed out of them, local community farms who make pennies. You're going to screw them? No, you're not. This is the one time I'm going to tell you all this is war. They want to piss on the one thing that means the most to us, then we're going to piss back. We pay the bills around here. We'll turn the gas off if we have to. If we have to go to the farms and pick the food ourselves and pay under the table, that's what we'll do. You want to see a riot, a food fight? That's a serious food fight. And listen, this bill was proposed by U.S. Representative Rosa DeLauro. She's a Democrat from Connecticut's 3rd District. She's 66 years old. She has a face like an old pair of shoes. And she's married to this man, Stanley Greenberg, who owns a research firm that provides strategic advice and research for companies, organizations, and campaigns that try to advance their issues amid shifting social currents. One of his clients, Monsanto. People, this is just growing. It's starting very small. It's been proposed to the House. It's been referred to the House of Agriculture. And it's in its infant stage, but it's going to grow. And we need to step on it and kill it with the biggest batch of food pesticide that we can muster. We must smash this the minute it starts to show life. I'm going to keep my eyes on the issue, and at the very first opportunity, we'll band together. We'll start a petition, or we'll sign one that's existing already, and we'll begin protesting there so it goes absolutely nowhere. Because they're not trying to help us. They're just trying to hurt us. And that's all I have to say about that. And I want to thank again Paradox from Brain Gravy for bringing that article and raising my blood pressure.
In a native tongue, Alaska means great land. One only needs to look around to see why. But recently, life has been far from great for an ill-fated few. A man walks 6 miles every day in 20 below weather to check his nets under the ice for fish. The nets have gone bare. A single father of five relies on his children's school lunch to keep them from starving. Small portions of dried fish keep him going for now.
Start trying to save food for the kids. Got no more stove oil. We use wood stove almost all night. Stay up to try to keep the house warm.
These people are victims of a perfect storm, and a slumping economy is just the tip of the iceberg. Their story is being heard thanks to independent journalist Dennis Zaki, who discovered their plight on a blog.
I found a link on a blog to a note that a Eskimo in a town called Imonic, Alaska, had sent into the local media.
When he followed through, he found a town living in frozen misery far from the rest of the world.
We're struggling with fuel prices, with food, having to choose stove oil versus food.
Oil prices have soared along with other commodities. These people expect to pay $20 for a dozen eggs and $10 for a gallon of milk. Much of this is due to an early winter that froze the Yukon River.
The supply boat that they had could not get up the Yukon to get to the towns, so it's stuck at the mouth of the Yukon. And flying anything in is highly expensive. People catch salmon, they sell them, and that's how they get money. And they also eat those salmon and stock them up. But last season, they only got 1/20th of the income they usually get, and it wiped out a lot of communities.
Locals blame controversial commercial fishing practices for depleting the bounty of salmon that have made their way up the Yukon River throughout history. Now, nuts, berries, and small game animals are the only items keeping many from starving until weather and life starts changing throughout this great land.
A lot of people say, you know, why don't they move? And these people don't want to move. They love living out that way. The families live out that way. The fish have been taken away. They didn't choose to have that. They want the fish. If they had the fish, just like in, you know, way back when, they would sell some fish and then they could buy things like heating oil. I spent 5 days in Ammonic and it's a beautiful place. Some of the nicest people I met in my whole life. Some of these families that had no food on the shelves, as soon as I walked in, said, can I get you something to eat? You know, they just want to live and be left alone.
Hey, you know, one thing I have not hit on here that I thought about talking about is what food magazines that you all read. I mean, what do you read? Do you take any food magazines? Do you take any magazines? I know some of you don't even read. Do some of you take food magazine subscriptions or do you buy them off the shelf? And if you do, which ones? It wouldn't really surprise me to find out that some of you don't read any of them. That's fine. But I'd be interested in finding out which food-related magazine or magazines that you read on a regular basis. So if you get a chance, comment and let me know, because I'm just interested. For me, I currently subscribe to Bon Appetit, and that's it. I was subscribing to Savoir, S-A-V-E-U-R. That's the magazine that I was getting. For the longest time, I took that. But I started to realize that it's more of a what's the world eating type of magazine rather than a real food magazine that I can get food issues from and recipes that I can cook. I mean, no disrespect to Savoir. It was a fantastic magazine, well written, very informative, great photography. But it's difficult to cook recipes that call for specialty items like tamarind toasted chickpea powder or Peruvian banana seeds, you know. They have on the back of the magazine, they'll have a resources section where you can actually find the items, mail order them and stuff. But I'm not going to special order ingredients for $40 so I can make a side dish. It seemed like a magazine that was full of food that I really couldn't experience unless I had bottomless pockets or could actually travel to these other countries to eat. So that magazine lost its luster after a while. It was still cool, but I just kind of felt like I told my wife, I said, I felt like it was like the equivalent of me being a really horribly unattractive dude who spent every night playing World of Warcraft, but I got a subscription to Playboy. You know, like I was ever going to meet one of these girls. It was nice to get the magazine. Anyway, Food Network has a magazine now, and there's another magazine that she bought me called Food. She goes, hey, you might be interested in this. I'm checking it out. Both of these magazines seem like a big commercial for Food Network and the Food Network personalities. They have recipes in there that are really basic, call for ingredients similar to what you'd find in Home and Garden or Family Circle on the back of a label for canned vegetables, these quick and easy type of meals, you know, pour a can of crap into another can of crap and mix it together and you got a meal. It's not a real resource for people who know how to cook already. It's a glossy advertisement for Food Network, and the kitchen appliances and the dishware lines and all these personalities are hawking, so I'm not really going to count those as food magazines. Now, they're good. Like I said, I always will honor Food Network for getting more people cooking at home, because that's the bottom line. Don't get me wrong. When you have fat asses like annoying Paula Deen, they're still providing recipes that call for mayonnaise, bacon, cheese, vegetables. Let's be fair. There are some recipes that call for frozen peas or canned green beans. That's not staying healthy. I mean, please, that's not cooking. But they are getting people to cook at home, even if it's with mayonnaise and cheese. But these magazines I think are actually worth reading are magazines like Bon Appetit, Cooks Illustrated, Gourmet, Food and Wine, Savoir. Never knew how to say that. Maybe that's why I stopped taking it, because I couldn't pronounce it. Anyway, just wondered what you do subscribe to, what you buy on a regular basis. Just because I've not discussed it before, I wondered which magazines you read that are about food. When my friend Jill and I attended that molecular cooking class at Sur La Table, you want to talk about, I mean, people spending money on food. There was a farmer's market that surrounded this place. That she had been there. She knew all about the place. Jill did. She goes, oh, it's like a chef's paradise. She took me into this market. They had more gourmet ingredients than I'd ever seen ever in one place. And I think, I told her this too, if I lived near there, I'd probably spend all my money in this one market. And I'm going to go back there too, because it's in LA. It's not far. And I'm going to do a whole expose on that place. And I wish we had something like that here. I wish we had more time then too, because I'd have spent all day in there. I love our farmer's market. But this farmer's market of Fairfax and 3rd in Los Angeles makes every other farmer's market look like 7-Eleven. Seriously, it's just amazing the stuff you see. Whole rabbits, all sorts of game. Everything was fresh and not expensive, really. But one of the things I saw was that a meat purveyor said Kobe beef. Right there in the window said Kobe New York strip steak, $79.99 a pound. And I thought to myself, this can't be right, could it? $80? I mean, for one thing, it's illegal to sell Kobe in the United States, from what I understand. And it's a shitload more expensive than $80 a pound. I looked at it. It was marbled. Just like, you know, Kobe steak, the stuff that I'd seen. It looked like the pictures I'd seen of Kobe beef. But I doubted that's what it was. So I fantasized about eating some of it, and then I forgot about it because it's just way too expensive. But then I read a post recently at Chadzilla, which is yet another website that Joe turned me onto. I swear to God, she's the most ravenous food reader I've ever encountered. I think she reads like 200 food blogs a day about food. But he wrote about what I kind of discussed in early episodes of our show here, which is that what we're getting here in America that we think is Kobe is actually Wagyu beef. And Wagyu beef is a hybrid of a Japanese cow that is bred with an American Black Angus cow. Now, Kobe is a place in Japan, and just like champagne, anything that's labeled with that must come from that area. Japanese cattle raisers in Kobe practice a system of stock unions where ranchers unite and crossbreed their cattle over a larger gene pool than the individual cattlemen can do by themselves. Does that make sense? Is that kind of how that works? So what that did was it allowed them to create superior breed of beef in a really short time frame. And the differences between what we grow and what the Japanese grow is that Kobe beef has about 20 to 25% fat compared to American prime cut, which is about 6 to 8%. And the Wagyu cattle that we have here are not kept to the same standards as Kobe cattle. They're allowed to roam free, do what they want. They get fed a diet of barley and wheat and alfalfa, but they don't drink beer or sake. They don't get rubbed downs with happy endings. They don't live that kind of life. But what we're left with Wagyu beef, is a higher fat content than what normal American beef is. And it's actually better for us with that fat because that fat has a higher level of conjugated linoleic acid, and that actually reduces cholesterol. In addition to that, the extra fat means that you don't have to cook the hell out of it. In fact, you know, if you do, you'll ruin it. You sear it on the outside just as you would like a piece of ahi tuna, and you leave it raw on the inside. And it's completely safe to eat it this way. It's the only kind of meat, really, that you can make carpaccio with and not worry about getting worms or some other bacteria that set up camp in your system. Now, if you cook Kobe or Wagyu too long, you're going to destroy exactly why you're buying it, for its delicateness. So if you want carpaccio or tartare, this is the kind of stuff you want to get your hands on. So that sign you're going to see at the meat market that says Kobe beef, that's not Kobe beef, unless you're paying about $500 a pound for it, and more than likely buying it under the table. It's Wagyu beef. It's still expensive, but it's worth every single penny. So BBC America is showing reruns from Gordon Ramsay's show F Word. The F stands for fresh or food. I think food. Maybe fresh and food. I don't know. Anyway, it's got the same style of yelling that he does at chefs. But he teaches people how to cook really fresh food. Shows how simple it is. He has these field reporters that go out. And it's got something really unique, and it's something I want to share with you because here, I think it's important to the show, and it kind of goes along with, you know, the theme anyway. Each season, he raises animals in his garden. And this season, it was lamb. And another year, it was turkeys. In 2007, he raised two pigs. From the time they were little piglets, he raised them in his garden. And it was this particular season that I felt was the most interesting. Not only because it was the first one I saw, but pigs are kind of the animals, I think, we have the hardest time to wrap our heads around in regards to actually bringing ourselves to witness their slaughter. Because they're cute animals. They're very smart. And a lot of people keep them as pets. And this particular season, he had Hugh Fernley Whittingstall from River Cottage, who we just read about earlier. And he came on in a lot of episodes, and he helped him with pointers on the show and how he could actually raise the pigs. And all of his animals, as it turns out, he's like, you know, like he said in the article, he's his guru for livestock. So his kids kind of grow attached to the pigs, and Ramsay does too. In one episode, he reads about how beer helps improve the flavor of the meat. So he goes into a beer store, he samples all these different beers, and decides on some cherry lambic. So one of the pigs, he decides to feed him lambic, and the pig gets drunk, and it's really hilarious. So he was feeding him natural food all year, fruits and vegetables, really high quality wheat grain. He said it cost him like 1,200 quid per year. Really expensive. But the quality of the meat was superb. Eventually, he throws this big barbecue with all of his friends and his family, and they eat the pigs, and he serves some of the meat in his restaurant. And he uses all of the pigs, the fat, the belly, and the tail. He uses the intestines to make the sausages. He makes his kids get involved in everything. It's really something. And it's so dead on with the article that we just read from Bon Appetit. In fact, I'm going to play some audio for you. And then I'm going to end the show. And then at the end of the show, I'm going to play some more audio from the barbecue. So stick around after the song and listen to some more of that. But the day finally comes. He's going to have to take these pigs to slaughter. It's really hard on him. But I respect that he does this. And that he had the balls to show it on his show. So like I said, I'm going to play some audio for you from this show. Because I want you to hear what a humane slaughter sounds like. And the information that this guy provides to him. Now, I'm sure you've seen or heard squeals and horror stories of traditional slaughterhouses and what violent deaths these animals suffer. Now, that's the difference between a humane and inhumane slaughter. So for those of you who don't think there is a difference, this might just be for you. And he's got a brass set of balls, I'm telling you, putting this on TV. He took it from critics one year. He showed the slaughter of these turkeys. Now, when they did the turkeys, I think it's like one of those things where it took a genius to figure out a way to make it as painless as possible for the turkeys. They took this long tube that was hooked up to electrodes. They hung the turkey upside down by his feet. They took this tube, this electrode tube, stuck it in the turkey's mouth, down its throat, pressed this button that shoots electricity into the turkey. The turkey goes, whang, and his, you know, his arms go, his wings go spread out. It sends it into a coma. Then they slit the turkey's throat, put a little plastic bag over the turkey, and they bleed the turkey out. Turkey never feels the knife. Okay? Never feels the knife. Anyway, they still came after him because he showed the slaughter of the turkeys. It was a pretty bloody episode. Animal rights groups were all over his ass in the UK, and I can only imagine the fallout that he's getting from this. So if you're squeamish, or the chicken thing that we did that earlier in the year with Jamie Oliver, if that got to you, you may just want to fast forward toward the end of the show, because after this, I'm going to wrap it up. But I'm going to play this in pieces, okay? So I'm going to play a piece, I'm going to talk, I'm going to play a piece, I'm going to talk, and then the last piece is the actual slaughter. So by that point, I'm going to warn you, so you can listen up to that point, and you can take off if you want, doesn't matter. Or if you want to stick around, stick around. But we're going to begin about a week from the day of the slaughter. At this, in this clip, he's afraid that the pigs are getting too much sun, and they're uncomfortable. So he calls Hugh Friendly Whittingstall to come check out his pigs and see if there's some kind of, you know, sunscreen he can put on them and make sure that they're very comfortable. Listen.
Gordon's going to have to deal with a difficult, very emotional day when they go to slaughter.
Come on, lady. They're beautiful.
He's feeling really quite attached to them at the moment. He's had a great spring looking after them. It's going to be a shock for him. The thing is, Gordon, actually, you've probably far exceeded the normal level of contact, even from a, you know, a regular pig man looking after his pigs.
Ready?
Probably doesn't get as emotionally involved as you have. Yeah. You've got a little under a week now. You've really got to start focusing on the fact that this is not family. They're not even family pets.
No.
You've reared them for meat. You've reared them for food.
Is it normal to feel guilty, though? Because that's what I've been feeling over the last 2 weeks.
I think you're going to feel guilty. I don't think there's any way around that. I mean, you could argue forever about the morality of whether we should or shouldn't eat meat. But one thing's for sure, if we are going to eat meat, we should look after our animals well.
Proper.
And you've done that. And in the end, it's sort of something you kind of have to deal with on your own. But I think you'll be all right.
Seriously, I had a hard time watching him with those pigs, too. He knew he was raising them for food. But he couldn't help get attached to them. They're cute. And his kids, too. All right, then that was the tough part. So now we're going to fast forward 1 week. It's the day he's going to take his pigs to the abattoir. Now, abattoir is French for a slaughterhouse. And that's where they humanely terminate the pigs. They clean them, and they butcher them. And there's one part in the audio where his little daughter says, "Goodbye, piggies." And that made me kind of sad. But, you know, you got to get through it. It's food. You got to remember, it's food. And I'm sure when he watched it back, it had to affect him a little bit. But listen closely here. When the guy is describing the process, listen, carefully listen. It's painless. The pig gets a bolt of electricity to the brain, and it literally sends him into an instant coma. So they can string the pig up, they slit its throat, and they bleed it out. There's nothing squeamish here, so you can keep listening. I'm going to stop it before it gets to the actual slaughter.
It's D-Day. My two pasture pigs, Trini and Susanna, have lived in my back garden now for the last 2 months. But today, they're going to the abattoir. I've raised the pigs myself to ensure the pork I'll serve in the F-word restaurant is of the highest quality. But this morning, my mind isn't on the recipes. Every morning the pigs run over to greet me, but today for the first time they've stayed in bed. It could be the rain, but I suspect somehow they know what's happening.
Out we come. Hey. Come on. Don't do this to me now. Come on.
Luckily, experienced pig breeders Christine and Kevin are on hand to help.
They're just like docile this morning, no?
Well, they don't want to come out in this weather.
Huh?
They probably know as well. They probably sense everybody's anxiety.
Do you reckon?
Yeah.
They pick up those things.
They pick up on that very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Come on, girlies.
There you go.
Good girl.
There you
come
on. There you go.
Just go backwards. They should just follow you.
Come on.
You
rattle.
I haven't fed the girls for 12 hours, as the slaughterhouse demands empty stomachs.
There you go. Good girl.
Come on, there ladies, this way. Good girl.
Did you see another one?
Good girl.
Bye, piggies.
Bye, piggies.
Okay, guys. Right, school time. Let's go.
I think it's worse for Gordon because he's got to go to the slaughter and carry it through. I think he's going to be really quite upset.
That was difficult, no?
I've chosen this small family-run abattoir as it caters for the independent breeder. It's owned by John Andrews, who's been a slaughterman since he was 18.
Hello.
Morning.
How are you, Al?
Not too bad, thanks.
Yeah?
Yeah, nice to meet you.
First time in an abattoir.
Is it?
Yeah, Christ.
Oh, well. The first thing we've got to do is knock them out.
Yeah.
Put them into a fit.
Yeah.
And then what happens is I must get them up quick, because everything dies by the knife in a slaughterhouse.
Right.
All right? So we've got to do it so it's humanely and they're unconscious.
Come on, ladies. Come on. There we go.
There you go. I'm not very happy to see you girls go. Yes? So I think it's sad, and I think it's very, very, very unfair, but you're going. Hey, just think of all those good times we had. Come on. I'm gonna get the f*** out of here. Jesus. It's f***ing hard saying goodbye. I just want to get this next bit over and done with. Just not looking forward to it and just hope it's f***ing rapid.
Okay, so now it's time to do the actual deed. So if any of you are squeamish at the idea of a humane slaughter, even anything, and you don't think you can handle listening to blood pouring out of a pig's throat, which is really all you're going to hear, that might even disturb you, then, well, thanks for listening. My Life is a Foodie. See you next time. For the rest of you who do respect the process and the truth that these animals do have to die because they are food and bacon does not grow on trees, here's the remainder of the segment. Back to the abattoir.
Next week in the F-Word restaurant, we've got pork on the menu. So you know what's going to happen next. And let me tell you, it's not for the squeamish. It doesn't get that messy in there, though, does it?
No.
I feel it's my duty to witness the slaughter of my pigs, but it's not something I'm looking forward to.
This is a slaughter hall.
I feel guilty. I've never been into an abattoir, you know that?
Do you?
Yeah, but, you know, I've cooked so many amazing things, but I've never f***ing been to an abattoir, which is, you know...
Well, you're in now.
I'm in now, exactly. Where should I stand, what's that in there, John? F***ing hell.
That's a blood pit. Hanging rail, scalding tank.
Right.
Shaving table, and away we go. Yeah.
So just run me through exactly. They come through the door.
I'm going to go and get them now.
Yeah.
Going to walk them down.
Yeah.
Walk them in here. Yeah. I should put them both in together.
Okay, good.
All right?
Yeah.
So I should be stunning one. Once that pig's been stunned enough, it's going to lay on its side, but it's going to kick.
Right.
All right? Warn you that now.
Yeah.
All right? Then I'm going to put a shackle on.
Okay. Where does that go?
That's going to go on the back leg. All right? Okay. Then she's going to go up on that hoist.
Yeah.
Onto that blood rail.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to lean across and cut her throat.
Okay, that's right. One at a time.
One at a time.
Yeah. What's that?
That's the tongs.
The tongs.
It's electrothalia stunning.
Right.
All right? So that tong there, it's basically going to put a current between the brain.
Right.
All right?
And you hear that just the temple?
On the temple.
Yeah.
Right. Stress, they walked in, they didn't know what's happening. When I was doing the first one, the other one took the notice.
When will they stop moving?
See, all that is, that's an involuntary movement.
It's just...
Involuntary. That animal's got no control over it at all. That's the worst of it.
Cool. F***ing hell. Yeah, I mean... It seemed fast. It seemed like it was, it's weird. You know, they're here 1 minute and now they're hanging with a throat slit. So, not pleasant.
For the men of the abattoir, slitting the pig's throat is just the start of the process. Then they put Trini and Susanna in a scalding tank that removes hair and several layers of skin.
I'm amazed at how white it's come out like that. Unbelievable.
The animal is shaved of any remaining hairs, then the pig is disemboweled.
Right, so I've loosened that already now. Now we're going to drop that through now.
It's an incredibly fast, skilled process.
Now the idea is to hang them now and sort of dry them for a bit in the fridge.
The whole operation is extraordinary. I mean, quite emotional in a way. I felt sick as a f***ing dog in there. I'll just, you know, think of something really exciting to cook with them in a way that can make me a little bit happy right now, but it's not a nice experience in there.
Gordon Ramsay's The F Word is on here in the States on BBC America. They replay episodes from all four seasons all the time, so check your local listings. I simply cannot recommend the show enough. For foodies, for people who really want the truth about food that we eat and the things that we put on our tables every day. Okay, but listen, that's all I have for this time, kids. I want to thank you all again for listening and for your support of the podcast. Music in this episode from Seether and Tipper. So if you like these songs, go to the link on our website, mylifeasafoodie.com. Download them in the iTunes store, 99 cents per song, and you own it, sort of. My name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie. And until next time, di salut. Shendan.
I bet Hugh that he wouldn't be able to tell which one of my pigs I've been feeding cherry beer and which was beer-free.
Right, you ready for the taste test, yes?
First of all.
So this is the loin. This is the tenderloin.
Tenderloin.
And a little bit of liver.
Yes.
Yep. That's so juicy.
Delicious.
To me, that just tastes of quality pork. Very, very good pork. So this is from the other pig, but I don't know which other pig.
That's right. If you thought of one plate that had been treated differently with alcohol, which would it be, the red or the blue?
I would go for the blue one, because it's tastier. It's just everything, the liver's a bit sweeter, and the pork a bit porkier. Yeah.
Well, that's extraordinary. Because the blue plate is no beer.
No beer, okay.
And the red plate
is the beer.
Was Susanna.
Okay.
Who got fed the beer.
Interesting.
Hugh got it wrong for the best of reasons. The meat from Susanna, the beery pig, has lost a little of the pork's natural sweetness.
Very nice
so he
too.
Chose the tastiest, but not the beeriest.
Well done.
That was worthwhile.
An interesting experiment, definitely. Time to marinate myself.